Today on Straight Talk Africa, the significance of the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali, and today we talk about lessons that we have learned regarding the Rwandan genocide that occurred 25 years ago. The genocide left an estimated 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, dead. Since then, Rwanda has made progress in recovering from the devastation and growing its economy. Rwanda now has the highest percentage of female parliamentarians in the world, more than 60% of that. VOA correspondent Mariama Jaro has more on this story.
It started on April 6, 1994, when a plane carrying Rwanda's Hutu president Juvenal Habyarimana and his Burundian counterpart was shut down. Mary Berry is an international studies professor at the University of Denver in Colorado.
There was a lot of confusion and, of course, a scramble for power within his administration. And over the next several months, the targets expanded, and Tutsi civilians in Rwanda became seen as the enemy. And the level of brutality, of course, was tremendous. Just over 3 months, perhaps 800,000 Rwandans were killed, and the vast majority of those killed were Tutsi.
Following the genocide, the Rwandan Patriotic Front's Paul Kagame became the nation's de facto leader, first as vice president to Pasteur Bizimungu and later president of the country. Fast forward 25 years later, people are still grappling with what happened. Nadine Yitegeka was only 3 when the genocide unfolded. She's a recent graduate from Rwanda's Akilah Institute for Women.
We have a generation now of people whose parents are in prison, a generation that is not like me. They don't even have any parents left. So trauma and healing, it's a process. We are at a good stage now.
One sign of that, the large number of women who became members of parliament.
We used to be a very patriarchal society, and seeing these women break these rules is inspiring. As a young woman, it's possible to do even beyond what they've done, because for me, there are challenges they faced that I won't have to.
Ironically, Rwanda's genocide opened the doors for women because most of the casualties were men. With a survival rate of 70%, women entered fields once closed to them. Women lawmakers, who make up more than 60% of the seats, have made a difference in crafting policy, according to Berry.
Perhaps the most notable one was a bill related to gender-based violence. And Rwanda's, because of female legislators' leadership on this issue, Rwanda became one of the countries in the world that really put forth progressive and innovative laws and also institutions related to countering and preventing gender-based violence.
But Berry, who wrote a book about women and violence in Rwanda and Bosnia-Herzegovina, says Rwandan women still have a long way to go.
There hasn't been a transformation of patriarchal power relations within the home or within marriage, and there has not been a fundamental, real transformation of how political power is wielded, because the political power in Rwanda is directly rooted and kind of held by the executive.
Berry says while the Rwandan government has benefited globally from its empowerment of women in parliament, she worries about the crackdown on political dissent with the recent jailing of female opposition leaders Victoire Ingabire and Diane Rwigara. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Mariama, for that report. Joining us here in the studio are two distinguished guests, Claude Gatebuche, a Rwandan genocide survivor and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network, and Jacques Niyibizi, head of the Rwandese community here in the greater Washington, D.C. area. And joining us from the Rwandan capital of Kigali is my VOA colleague, Edward Rwema, from the Central Africa Service. The ambassador of Rwanda to the United States and the permanent representative to the United Nations were not able to be on our show due to a scheduling conflict. Now let's go to Eddie in the capital, Kigali. Good evening, Eddie.
Good evening, Shaka.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you? How is Washington today?
I am hugely terrific here. Walk us through the preparations for the 25th celebrations.
I would say for the past few days I've been here, preparations started over the weekend on Saturday, where there was the usual Umuganda, which is the collective cleaning of the city. But this time, because of the Kwibuka 25, or remembering the 25th anniversary of genocide in Rwanda, most of the cleaning was held at genocide museums, basically preparing for the major event, which is expected to take place on the 7th of April this coming Sunday. But besides that, there are other events that are happening here in the capital, Kigali. From today to Friday, Rwanda is hosting a major international conference on genocide, basically where they will be reflecting on what happened 25 years ago, how to preserve the memory, and also how to teach the future Rwandans and the future generation of the globe on how to be able to prevent anything like what happened in Rwanda 25 years ago.
Eddie, I know that you have in the past covered some other anniversary celebrations. How particularly unique or special is this particular one?
The last time I was here covering the genocide commemoration was 20 years ago, and I think at that time that's when Rwanda decided that instead of holding annual genocide commemoration on national level, they would rather have it every 5 years. So this is the first batch of 5 years that Rwanda is commemorating this genocide commemoration. And this time they have invited several heads of states here from our sources that close to 15 heads of states and government are coming. Among them, we've heard that the Prime Minister of Belgium, Charles Michel, is going to be attending this time. Previously, we had heard that Rwanda had invited the French president and Emmanuel Macron, but because of reasons beyond our knowing, we were told that he's instead going to be represented by a member of parliament who actually was born here around the genocide time, and then was flown to France, where was adopted by the French people. Besides that, we also heard that there's going to be many African presidents, especially those from the west of Africa, and other senior dignitaries, including the Governor General of Canada, Julie Payet.
Eddie, talk to us about the mood. Give us a sense of the mood among the people downtown Kigali, for example, that you have interacted with.
Well, the mood right now is a mood of remembrance, a mood of talking and reflecting on what happened 25 years ago. Rwanda is commemorating this year's when we have a very big percentage of Rwandan youth who were born after the genocide. A few of them I interacted with have said that they are optimistic about the future. They think that they're the majority in this country, and they want to see this country move forward, trying to not to be delayed or pulled back by what happened in 1994, though others still have that thinking that a real reconciliation has not been achieved, though the country, through its Unity and Reconciliation Commission, says that there is a lot that has been done in concerning people living together. Kids we talk to, they say, we are ready to forgive, but we're not ready to forget. All we want is to work for a better Rwanda, and that's what everybody we've been meeting is talking about right now.
And as you interact to people on the ground, do you get the sense that people are more united than they were, for example, 10, 15, 20 years ago?
Shaka, I was here in 2017, and I was able to interact with families, which involved families of the killer and families of the victims. These families had moved to the extent where their kids got married despite what the two families or what the parents went through during the 1994 genocide. Most of the Rwandans here, the ones I talk to, they feel they would rather be seen in the mirror of Rwandans rather than being seen in the mirror of ethnicity. And this is a campaign that has been pushed by the government of Rwanda through what it calls Ndumunyarwanda, so basically trying to preach that Rwandans should look at themselves as Rwandans and work together to the good of their nation rather than being dragged by ethnicity and other issues that divide them.
Any particular developments that you have been able to experience or you have been able to observe that surprised you so far?
Well, each time you come to Kigali, for sure, there's always going to be something new that you're not used to. The Kigali itself, you're a journalist like I am. You've been following the developments, whether through reports and other publications. And again, the other thing that impresses me a lot is the amount of youth you meet who are either in very good positions, decision-making positions, who are thriving and ready to probably take this country to a next level.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, really, for sharing your insight and observations with us.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome, Eddie. Let me come to here to Claude Gatebuchi and, of course, Jacques Niyibizi. I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you two on Straight Talk Africa, and in the case of Niyibizi, for the first time.
Thank you, Shaka.
Likewise. Thank you, Shaka. Yeah, as you know, I'm a long-time listener, first time on the show. It's a pleasure.
You're most welcome. Have you also been a sort of fan or something of that sort?
A sort of fan?
A fan.
Oh, I'm a big fan, yes.
Really?
Oh, definitely I'm a big fan of your show.
How big is big?
That's what I'm saying, long-term listener. More than once I've listened to your shows and through my my friends. Actually, and I've known Eddie for some time, and I also know Jackson Mvunyi. For some time, we do play basketball together beside our professional work. So I tend to listen to all VOA programs. First about the radio and then the TV shows, yeah.
Let me be a little bit selfish and perhaps ask something that reflects the Straight Talk Africa program that I have the privilege, the honor of hosting. Any particular reason why you are a fan of Straight Talk Africa?
Well, Straight Talk Africa, when I started listening to it, was primarily because of the concern of the problems Africa is facing, you know, in my era. From the beginning when we were born, actually I was born in Burundi with my Rwandan parents, who left back in the late 50s, and so I grew up as a refugee in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my education over there, some of my education, and the rest I did it here in the U.S. So back then, you know, we used to issues that were in around the Great Lake region, like in Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, and Uganda, if you want to speak about the Great Lakes, but it can go beyond.
Mm.
So there were so many issues all the time, so it never stops. So there were issues of people migrating from one country to another, and so that put me in a mood of listening to the news, being a small, young student in elementary school, And I remember my dad used to put a radio so we can listen to the, listen to the news instead of just maybe listening to sports, or back then there were no televisions, but later on they came on and then we can watch them on TV. Yeah.
Very interesting. So you really have been a fan of Voice of America, because Straight Talk Africa, as a matter of fact, began on August 2nd, the year 2000.
Wow. Yeah.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Let me come to you, Gatebuchi.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm doing terrific.
Really?
Yeah. As terrific as you are.
I thought you'd be doing a little bit more terrific than me. In fact, that you would probably be doing hugely terrific.
I am hugely terrific. I stand corrected.
I like that. Now, Claude, you heard, of course, the report from the Rwandan capital, Kigali, through my colleague, Eddie. Your response?
There's a couple of things that I would like to highlight, both from Eddie's report and the report before. First thing is they talked about women in parliament and moving, to empower women. But as has been demonstrated in the last two elections, in 2010 and 2017, the government of Rwanda actually cracks down on women who do not speak the language that Paul Kagame dictates.
Or who develop an appetite for the highest office in the land?
Not just that. There's obviously Victoire Ingabire in 2010, and there was Diane Rwigara in 2017. But there were also, I just want to highlight a couple, two journalist women who were jailed, sentenced to 4 years and 7 years for criticizing the president. There has been women in opposition who have been found dead. There is Illuminé Iragena, who's been missing since 2016. There has been assault on women. And also, what I wanted to highlight about the parliament in Rwanda, which is a result of the genocide, is the women in parliament are not very empowered. Just 2 weeks ago, I think, maybe last week, there was a government minister, her name escapes me, who was promoting or apologizing for rape. She was criticizing a young woman who is an artist who took nude photos and basically said, if you get raped, you ask for it. You know, those are the type of things. But the first thing I want to do here is really honor and commemorate our loved ones that passed away, that were killed in the genocide in 1994. I lost dozens of family members during that genocide. I almost lost my life on multiple occasions, including one where I actually was at the point where they had ordered me and my mother to dig our own grave, and they were ready to kill us. So I want to honor the victims. I want to honor all the Rwandans. There were Tutsis killed in that genocide. There were Hutus killed in that genocide. There were Twa people who were killed in that genocide. And I want to honor all of them, every single one of them. And lastly, the Twa people in Rwanda, who are the indigenous and the original inhabitants of the country of Rwanda, are almost on the brink of extinction. And they were the first people in the country of Rwanda. But no one talks about them. I do want to honor...
They're invisible.
Exactly, yeah. Because they are not part of this power struggle and competition for power. But I do think that also we have failed over the years since the genocide in Rwanda by giving Kagame carte blanche to kill inside of Rwanda and outside of Rwanda, invading the Congo, committing what the UN has characterized as genocide themselves, and have let him off the hook. No justice for those victims.
We'll come back to more of that later. What about you, Jack?
Well, first of all, thank you, Shaka, for hosting the show. And like I said, I'm a long-time listener and first time on the show.
You're most welcome.
And I had no idea I was going to be talking politics. but here we are, and I have to defend my country. So what Claude just stated about the genocide, yes, the genocide is a genocide for Tutsis, So there can be multiple different ways of describing genocide, because a genocide is something that is prepared, it's planned to target one specific ethnic group. And in case of Rwanda, that's what happened. In case of Germany, you know about the Nazis, how they killed, you know.
Correct. Even though the last time I checked, when it came to the ICTR, the International Criminal Court for Rwanda, the UN, in Arusha, most of the people, in fact, taken there on those particular cases, those cases were dismissed.
Yeah, I can't speak to that, but I'm just speaking to the fact that one recognized genocide is the genocide of the Tutsis that happened in 1994, and it was more than a million, actually, if you want to go statistically. And then, of course, those were killed, including all the moderate Tutsis and the Twa, like Claude mentioned, is another category, ethnic group in Rwanda that most of the time people may not talk about it, but they do exist. And I disagree with Claude when he says like a Twa kind of messed in Rwanda, no one talks about him. Actually, in Rwanda, even Kagame give him cows, you know, on public televisions. that's a recognition that they are there. And actually, they're in the military, they're in the government, they're very smart people, actually, if you want to talk in details. But that's the thing that I know.
A single Twa general, for example, as we talk?
Yes.
Who?
I'm not gonna mention names because of privacy.
But what do you mean privacy?
Because of privacy, I'm not gonna mention names. I'm not gonna finger point here on a national television. But I know there are in the military, many of them, actually that I know. But I'm not gonna mention them for just for privacy
and
reasons.
And you know
yes.
A specific individual who happens to be a Twa and is a general?
Yes.
Are you talking to us from the deepest, better part?
Yes.
Of the bottom of your Rwandan heart and soul?
From the bottom of my heart, yes.
Interesting. Where were you, by the way, during the genocide?
So during the genocide, I was in Burundi, in Bujumbura. And just myself, I was a young person in my early 20s. Mm. And actually, if you want to know, if I need to go in greater details, I was part of a group that wanted to go fight to enter my country because I was forbidden to go into my motherland. Mm. And the reason I did not join the military is because I was working and I had a small job, and then I had to support our group that was outside of Rwanda. They were trying to enter Rwanda. Mm. So then I did not go. So basically all my friends who could go, and actually many of them that went, did die during the genocide. And as you see me, you know, I was like a 22, 23. Mm. Many of the guys that I grew up with, they're already gone. So you know how that feels, and growing up, and you know.
They went in the front line.
Exactly.
And very interesting. Let's go to a survivor and look at the story of one of the survivors of the Rwandan genocide. Here is Lydia.
I lost all my children, my husband, my parents, the parents of my husband, and all their families. Long ago, when someone lost a husband, her family or other people would help her. But for us, it was different. You would think you're the only one in that situation. But later, you realize that there are others like you. One thing that hurt me most was to lose my siblings, my children, and my husband. After they had killed my children, they took me to the leader of the Interahamwe. He raped me in public. They took turns to rape me, one after the other. It is a deep thing. I can never forget. I have forgiven them. I even did not take them to the Gacaca courts. I forgave them.
Thank you. Let me come to you immediately, Claude. you were a victim. How old were you? Were you like 10 years old or
something? I was 14.
You were 14?
When it started, when it happened.
How does it feel like when you walk back in memory lane? What about the kind of trauma that must have gone through? Do you still go into that?
Yeah, I still live with it. I have the nightmares. I still hear the screams of people screaming for help. Sometimes the nightmares of being taken to be killed or even seeing, because I not only was spared, but I had the trauma of seeing people get killed while we were escaping. There was one of my, called him my big brother. My next door neighbor chopped him to pieces right in front of everybody.
Really?
Yes. And I saw that, I almost puked. But because of how things were at that time, you couldn't afford to show emotions. The rest of his family later was made to escape. The militias who killed his brother decided they wouldn't kill the rest of the family, and they sent them away.
Who were those militias?
The extremist Hutu militias, the Interahamwe. That's who I saw killing this guy. Now, as we were escaping, his younger brother was shot by the RPF as the RPF was chasing to take over the territory.
How do you know that particular soldier was RPF?
Well, we know because it was the RPF taking over, and right after that, the RPF had control of that area.
But the RPF,
we were surrounded by those soldiers.
The RPF are credited for liberating you.
The RPF did not liberate. They won the war. And as you could see, during the war from 1990 to 94, right before the genocide, there had been 1 million people who decided to become homeless instead of living in areas controlled by the RPF. Because the RPF was so brutal, they called people to meetings, and they would kill hundreds of people. There is a case of the Byumba Stadium massacre where they rounded up and filled the stadium with people overnight. And then in the morning, they came out, and one of the, I believe it was, if I remember correctly, it must be General Kabarebe that was out there leading this
operation.
James Kabarebe, who was a previous Minister of Defense in Rwanda, ordered the massacre. I may have that name wrong, but it's one of the top generals in Rwanda that ordered the massacre in the Byumba Stadium.
Did you see him personally, or have you read that in some book?
I'll give you a reference. The book In Praise of Blood.
I have read that.
That book, published by Judy Rever last year, has that reference. There is the case of the Giti massacres. Mm. There is the case of the massacre of the Catholic priests and the people who were sheltering in the Kabwayi area. There is a woman who she has a radio show. I'm forgetting her name. She lost her son. She's a Tutsi woman. She survived the genocide. She lost her son along with those Catholic priests and bishops. The RPF came to take over the country. Now, also, I'll give you another reference. Romeo Dallaire, who was leading the UN peacekeeping mission. In his book, he states that Kagame told him that Tutsis inside of Rwanda had to be sacrificed for his victory. You cannot make an omelet without breaking eggs. That was Kagame's own words. So there are references.
That's completely fabrication.
This is, you can take that up with General Dallaire if you think it's fabricated. These are all not my own words. These are words coming from RPF members. Now, I've also gotten my own testimony. I've got video evidence from some of the members of the RPF. I have footage where they talked about how they had cleaning groups that came behind the RPF front lines and cleaned and basically killed people in those areas. And anybody that went to an area controlled by the RPF, it was ghost towns.
Now, people besides the information that you have since learned from some books, some authors. How do you respond to some people who look at you and find it difficult to believe that you are indeed a genocide survivor? That in fact, if you were a genocide survivor, you probably would give some credit to the Rwandese Patriotic Front, which liberated you,
according to them. Personally, I survived because of multiple people. There were neighbors, there were even strangers, people who came to the rescue on multiple occasions and helped us get away from the murderers. That's what happened. That's my story. The RPF was nowhere to save me. You know, on top of that, the RPF kept encroaching and attacking the various areas, and they were dropping bombs, and people were dying. So I kept escaping and escaping away from the bombings also. Just like if somebody dropped a bomb here, we would all take off running. That's what was happening. So for someone to state that I was saved by the RPF is incorrect. It is true. There are some people who were hiding in the hills or in the rivers, in places where after the RPF took over, they found them and rescued them. That's no doubt.
What about you, Jack? How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, thanks, Shaka. All the things that Claude just talked about, the RPF did not save people, they ordered the massacres, they're all total fabrication. And then he mentioned Judy River. Judy River, she's a self-proclaimed person. She's a writer. She never been in Rwanda. She never put a foot in Rwanda. She has. Congo.
She's been to Rwanda.
Now that I know, it's not written anywhere.
I know it.
She was
it
in Congo.
In the book.
She was in Congo, and she was with Interahamwe's, interviewing the Interahamwe's. How can you, seriously, you talk to somebody who's fleeing the country because these are people, they got kicked away because, you know, RPF was trying to take over and get out of here so we can save our people, whoever is in there, let's save them.
Jack.
And they go to Congo, and then Julie River goes there and interviews the Interahamwe's. These are the killers, protected, shielded by French soldiers. And then she interviews him, and then she believes their stories.
Jack,
more
I have
than
read,
the ones who are in
I
Rwanda.
Have read that book written by Jody.
Yep.
And to be very honest with you, I had also witnessed certain aspects that she talks about and could be very easily corroborated. So to that extent, I can say frankly, without any hesitation, that I regard her as a legitimate Canadian journalist who was doing her
job.
She's
a Tory journalist trying to self-proclaim herself.
But let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What lessons have we really learned out of that genocide? What do we need sincerely to do so that that genocide does not recur in Rwanda, nor does it in fact happen anywhere in the Great Lakes region? Because as we talk, the Great Lakes region does not look good at all.
No, it does not. You are correct, Shaka. The matter, you know, the fact of the matter, things that we have to do is actually what Rwanda, the Rwandan leadership is doing. Actually, President Kagame always emphasized about this. And I'm not talking because, you know, of the talk, but this is what's happening. People are trying to reconcile, right? Reconciliation is a big factor in terms of putting all the people together and unite the people and renew. And this is a theme, even Kwibuka 25, also three, remember, renew, and then unite.
But can you give me any incontrovertible evidence about reconciliation? Something
so
that is beyond talking the talk. And in fact, walking that particular talk, because that is very important.
Thank you, Shaka.
We should not simply talk about the rebranded Rwanda. We should talk about the reality in Rwanda as it is.
So the reality is, there's so many ways I can explain this, but let me just talk about social, in a social way, right?
Mm.
Like in Rwanda right now, today, You may have heard into this court, something called the Agachacha.
Yes.
Agachacha is a local tribunal.
Right.
You know, because, you know, before you forgive somebody, right, they have to face, you know, a court, right? And then you say your side, and the other person says their side.
They have to first admit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the Gacaca court had to determine who was wrong and who was right. So, and in Rwanda, that's what saved a lot of people in Rwanda. And all this genocide militias, you know, those who involved who killed other people in Rwanda, who killed mm-hmm. the Tutsis and other moderate Hutus, there were many in prisons, and then most of them were taken out of prison, and they came to leave and they went to their things because of the Gacaca court. Mm. Because they went, they said, well, we know we did bad, we killed, and can you, you know, forgive us? And actually, there were some documentaries I was watching before I came to the show. This guy, he was part of the militia, the Interahamwe, mm. and he killed, actually, his neighbors. He was talking to another woman who he killed her husband and the kids, but she survived. So they were showing, it's very emotional. Uh-huh. So this lady, she's a Tutsi, and the guy is a Hutu. So they now work together. For some reason, they went to a Gacaca court, and she forgave him, and then the other guy took forgiveness and then said, yes, I know I did wrong to you. I will never do it again. And so there's so multiple cases like that. And now they work together. They have a business. They help each other.
If true, that is obviously a very good development. But let's go, if you don't mind, to the lifeline of the show for a moment. Those are the telephone calls. And then I'll come back to you. Hello, Tedla. Good afternoon. Are you in New York?
Good afternoon, Shaka. It is very amazing. When I followed the Rwandan genocide 25 years ago, I came to this new apartment. So for me, this story is vivid to me. And what I want to tell you, Shaka, is that while I'm hearing from your panelists, still now the reconciliation, even the story of this happens or not happen, is still in debate. But for me, as an African, you mentioned the danger of genocide, but you failed to mention one story which will put Africans in a very dangerous spot now. It's not everywhere. Ethiopia. In Ethiopia, tribalism is institutionalized. There are mass media who are 24/7 accusing one tribe about what happened 150 years ago, and the government is not listening. And what I'm afraid is that Rwanda's case, which is started by radio, agitating now, social media, Facebook, are all is about one tribe against another. So the danger for Africa is, where is the African Union? If the African Union legitimizes tribal parties, then they should legitimize like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab also. African Union should really ban all those tribal parties in any part of Africa, please.
Tedla, you seem to have a new bleed of an African leader in Addis Ababa by most indications, and we're talking about Abiy Ahmed. If Abiy Ahmed were somewhere in Addis Ababa listening to Straight Talk Africa, what would you say to him?
Here is what I will say to Abiy Ahmed. When he came to America, with all my friends were cheering for him, believing that he is a new breed, different from Wallace Zenawi, who believes in human rights, who believes in not in tribalism as an Ethiopian. But now, in 1 year time, what I see is that he joined now his club. He is now replacing the Tigray elites with the Oromo elites in Addis Ababa. They are now even trying to take Addis Ababa as the capital of the Oromo region. So Abiy Ahmed, he speaks one thing, but what he practices is different. So
I see. Thank you very much. Let me come to you back, Jacques. Mm-hmm. You talk about you gave us a case, a very interesting case, really, of a sort of reconciliation. What about the fact, for example, that not long ago we had a show here, and we were blessed with a Rwandan Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Regional Integration, and the East African Community, Ambassador Olivier Nduhungirehe. He could not talk with his fellow Rwandans. He could not. Is that the way you look at reconciliation?
I really did not follow that, but
yeah,
I've
but
heard
he could,
it.
He could not interact with his fellow Rwandans on a show.
Was it they were speaking Kinyarwanda or English? Maybe there was a misunderstanding of language-wise. Was it a show in English?
We were all speaking in a language that would be considered standard English.
Yeah, Ashaka, I really don't know.
And but is that a good thing if it happened? In
no, it's not a good thing, I know. And that's what I was talking to Claude earlier.
And if,
on.
In fact, if Ambassador Nduhungirehe Olivier were actually watching this particular program or listening to this particular program, what would you say to him and his colleagues?
What? You know, what I would say to him as an official in the Rwandan government, you're supposed to really unite people and then listen to them. And it's shocking that an official, government authority lacks that, way of talking to his fellows. I mean, to me, unless he has something against his fellows, other than that, he will not be a good leader. To begin with, or maybe has something personal. You never know. As a leader, I think you're supposed to be open to all sort of people in your country, you know, small, you know, middle-aged, you know, older, and without, you know, regard to, you know, to ethnic groups or anything like that. So it's shocking to hear that.
I have done some bit of homework, and I'm afraid that the answer I got from my sources were, in fact, that this may very well be not Nduhungirehe's fault or anything, that, in fact, you are probably looking at government policy.
Yeah, I can't
He's actually told me that. I've talked to
Nduhungirehe. I can't speak to that, actually, Shaka, because I represent Rwandan.
No, but you are Rwandese.
I'm a Rwandese.
And
I live here.
First of all, if you are Rwandese, really, you have to have, for example, a right to own an opinion.
Correct.
Even if that opinion were to be diametrically different.
That is correct.
Freedom
of expression.
The ruling party, the RPF, and the government, correct?
Yeah, I didn't tell you that I'm an RPF. I represent the Rwandan diaspora here.
But you paid money to support the RPF when they were fighting a war, right?
You're a Rwandese citizen.
Back when we were in Burundi, yes.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I supported them.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, you're free to support anybody.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, but right now I'm here as a DMV president.
No
so
problem.
The DC, Maryland, and Virginia are community presidents. So I support all Rwandans who are here, all categories of Rwanda, if you want to be specific.
Very good.
So Rwandans.
Well, but we are talking about reconciliation. You cannot reconcile with yourself. You have to reconcile with some people who may, in fact, have opinions that are different from yours. Because when you talk about making peace, who do you in fact make peace with? You don't make peace with your friends. You make peace with your adversaries, correct?
That is correct, Shaka. And that's what we're trying to do here in the U.S., you know, in my district, what as a DMV president. That's what I'm trying to do, to reach out to those people who never showed up for the diaspora activities. And I have many of them. I go to their weddings. I go to their ceremonies, you know, beyond even Richmond.
What is the response
the other
so
day.
Far?
The response is very massive, actually. They are saying, we're going to work with you because there's no other leader who tried to reach out to us. And I'm going the extra mile to really talk to them and then tell them, guys, this is new. This is our time. This is our moment. Let's make things change. Let's collaborate. If we don't renew, we don't reunite, it's not going to help the future. And then also I emphasize on the youth of Rwanda, specifically those who are here in the U.S., the entire U.S. Yeah. So we have activities going on with the youth to bring them back and then give them some leadership lessons so they can learn from us.
Unfortunately, Jacques, there is no democracy in Studio 47. I am being ordered, instructed by the producer to go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers, and I hope you don't mind.
Not a problem at all.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Tafa from the Great Republic of Ghana. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa after a very long time. Hello, Tafa, can you hear me? Well, I'm afraid that I cannot hear Tafa.
Hello?
Yes, please.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Are you Tafa?
Yeah, Tafa from Ghana.
Yeah, it's very, very nice to have you back on the line. It's been a very, very long time since I heard your beautiful name.
Yes, sir, Shaka.
Thank
I hope you are doing can you hear me, Shaka?
Yes, please. Go for it.
Thank you very much. Shaka, I have a humble appeal to my brothers in Rwanda. You see, you ask very important questions that what do we do or what Rwandese will do not to have what happened to good people of Rwanda to repeat themselves. And that is very, very important. But when I listen to your guests, I can see that some of them seem to have some bitterness in them. And honestly, Shaka, my appeal goes direct to politicians. This kind of pressure and trafficking in Africa is being driven by politicians who did not to benefit or serve the interest. But I am appealing to them that Rwanda has come far. Today, Rwanda has doing many things, good things that we are all witness in Africa. To the extent that Shaka, could you believe today, Ghana is learning policy from Rwanda.
Exactly.
If you are aware about the Rwandan health, they have this drone delivering medical equipment and medicine all over Rwanda. Today, Ghana is learning that from them. And I think it is a plus for Rwanda. So I am appealing to politicians. They should put politics aside and think about their people. Because what's happening in Rwanda during the 90s is barbaric. And no African person would like to see this thing happen again. I am begging politicians. But they are the main cause of the problem in Africa. Because of they want to be in power, so they will hide under the trouble. They will be pushing their chapmen to do to poison their mind against their opponent for their own selfish interest, which is affecting the ordinary African. I am begging them, let's put the interests of Rwanda first before
now,
our own interest. Thank you very much.
Now, what about Mr. Tafa? Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
What about then the idea perhaps that Rwanda in turn, if in fact Ghana is learning from some things from Rwanda, what about perhaps also suggesting that perhaps Rwanda may also try to learn democracy Ghanaian style?
I agree, Shatta. I agree perfectly with your opinion. I agree. Rwanda also need to learn. Because, look, it's in the interest of the current president in Rwanda to also allow democracy to work. Some of the way he handled his opponent, honestly, I'm not a fan of him, even though I'm happy some of the good things he's doing. But the way he's managed, the way he dealt with the opposition is not the best. Sometimes embarrassed the whole continent. Honestly, I agree with you. You also have to learn the way Ghana is free. Ghana, no politician there to do what's doing there. I cannot assure you that. No politician, whether you are in power, you dare not to do what things he's doing in his country. So I agree with that. They also, for their own interest, because when you push people to the wall, they will bounce back and hit you. Thank you very much, Shaka.
Thank you very much, Tafa. Perhaps it should be, in fact, Ghana's responsibility and perhaps continental obligation to make sure that its type of democracy can, in fact, be spread across the continent, because I remember that on March 6th, 1957, Ghana was the first black nation on the African continent to regain its political independence. And the Prime Minister then, the great Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the kid from Nkrofu, actually made a very, very important statement in Accra that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it was linked with the total liberation of the African continent. And he did not simply talk the talk, by the way. He actually walked the talk by providing the necessary tools so that the rest of Africa could, in fact, walk the walk. How about that, Jack?
That is totally correct. Yeah, we can definitely model Ghana's democracy as all Africa nations. But make no mistake, Rwanda also has, like Tafa said, made a whole lot of progress. You know, you build upon what you have. Yes. So he started again, you know, looking at where
Ghana,
Rwanda came
Rwanda
from.
Rwanda is, among other things, really, Rwanda is best known for effective service delivery.
That is correct.
Service delivery.
And it didn't come just overnight.
No, but the question, frankly, is, when you look at democracy and service delivery, are they mutually exclusive or are they mutually reinforcing?
They are mutually reinforcing, I would say so. They work hand in hand. I mean, you're going to have democracy. Democracy has to work also in providing services. So it's a hand in hand.
Democracy is the infrastructure. It is the foundation.
It is the foundation of everything. You gotta be
fair.
Precisely. You gotta be fair in all your doings.
We're talking about social, economic, political justice for all.
Correct.
Not selective.
That is correct.
Let's talk about the empowerment of women. Rwanda is also, obviously, as we saw, listen to the piece, it has the distinction of having the highest per capita, I suppose, if not raw numbers, in terms of women in government, you know, positions and especially parliament. The question is, how are those ladies, how do they end up in parliament? Are they chosen by a specific individual, appointed, or in fact, are they elected by the people?
There is no such thing as election in Rwanda. It's a sham.
It's a show.
What do you mean there is no election in Rwanda?
There is an election.
In order to have an election that's credible, so there's no such thing as a credible election in Rwanda. Because in order to be credible,
are they elected or are they appointed?
Selected.
Selected.
Basically,
by who?
What you have is the representatives of the ruling party, the RPF, which is led by Kagame.
Are they all members of the RPF?
Nope. The overwhelming majority are.
Nope.
Okay.
The majority are. And the rest of them are those who have decided to work under the umbrella that the RPF has set up.
So are you suggesting that they owe allegiance to the appointing authority?
100%.
And not?
100%.
Their constituencies.
Because the opponents, the opposition, the opponents who are credible, and who have been repressed really badly, Bernard Ntaganda, P.S. Imberakuri. He does not have members of parliament in the government. Victoire Ingabire, she doesn't have members of her party in parliament.
Her party, Diane last Fugana, time I checked, I think is not even registered.
They've blocked them from registering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about those ones who are registered, actually. Yeah.
But
let's
in order to register, you have to abide and agree to the policies of the RPF, which is the definition of a dictatorship. If you don't go along, you're not going to make it in that government. And one more thing, Shaka. Empowerment of women. Look next door. What the RPF, the government of Rwanda, has done. Invaded the Congo, started this war, that's killed over 6 million people. The majority are children under the age of 5, and hundreds of thousands of women have been raped. What are those women in Parliament in Rwanda saying about that? Dr. Denis Mukwege, when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he said that we should have a justice process to prosecute and go after those who are documented in the UN mapping report that was released in 2010. What are those women who are empowered in Rwanda's parliament saying about these women?
I think we need to have a special edition on that issue.
Yeah. I can't go too much in details on that. All I know, in Rwanda, the women in our parliament, they're overwhelmingly, I think it's 60%+.
Right.
I think we're number one in the world that has that percentage. And then there's no any other meaning to that. It's because statistically, it has shown that any family that's led, that has the women has the responsibility in that family, that has a meaning. Let's say, meaning what I mean is having a job. Mm. You know, you can provide your family. Mm. There is a higher success rate that family will not go of hunger or anything, you know. That household would do well.
Jacques, it can also be agreed, by the way, that at least in terms of symbolism, it is also very good, very uplifting for the girl child to be able to see the aunts and what have you in positions of power. But what about those who say that what we are talking about here really is women who have positions and ranks but have no authority?
I would say in case of Rwanda, I think those women, I'm going to disagree what Claude said about the women in Rwanda. I think the women in Rwanda, they have a powerful task. You know, these women, very challenging. There are women who have many responsibilities.
Unfortunately, the time happens not to be our best ally, but I would like to make this point.
Yes.
A former president of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, once said, even with prosperity, without freedoms, freedom, for example, of expression, freedom, for example, of speech, freedom of the press, of the media, freedom of association, freedom of worship, it is a fundamental poverty. Would you agree?
I would definitely agree 100%. You gotta have a freedom of expression and express yourself the way you want it, you know, freedom of the media.
So if you applied such a yardstick to the Republic of Rwanda, how does Rwanda look like 25 years
Rwanda
after genocide?
Some people mistaken what Rwanda is doing now. I think the success of Rwanda is making, you know, all those sectors actually
unfortunately, yeah. And I hope you'll forgive me, time is not our best ally. Oh. On that note, our distinguished guests are Eddie Rwema, Jacques Niyibizi, and Eddie Rwema joined us, of course, earlier from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. And of course, we have Ndugu Gatebuche. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Rwanda. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive. Oh.